Welcome to Sipha Speaks. October is Black History Month, and the theme for this year is Time for Change, Action, Not Words. It encourages us to remember the achievements and contributions that Black people make to the UK every day. In this special edition of Sipha Speaks, we talk to Black people working across Sipha and in the public sector who share their experiences and why Black History Month is so important. We'll hear from Penina Achieng-Kimberg, who is Senior Finance Business Partner at Ministry of Justice UK. We speak to Jo Seeley, who is the new Chair of the Sipha Board, and also co-founder and COO of Greater Pacific Capital. And finally, we'll hear from Lorraine Ashley, who is Sipha's International Project Coordinator. First up, it's Penina Achieng-Kimberg.
Hi, Penina, and thanks for joining us today on this special edition of Sipha Speaks for Black History Month.
Hi, Chantel. Thank you so much for having me. I am very pleased to be here with you, talking to you during this very important period of the year.
Thank you. Throughout this month, we've been celebrating our Black members and hearing their stories and experiences of being Black while working in public finance. So firstly, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us about your role at the Ministry of Justice and how you ended up there?
Yeah, definitely. So my name is Penina Achieng-Kimberg, and I am currently Senior Finance Business Partner working in probation. So probation is an agency that sits under the Ministry of Justice. So this specific role is really focused on change programs which sit under services like electronic monitoring and reducing reoffending. So the government has got these significant ambitions where they just really want to improve outcomes for people and reduce the number of people who come into the criminal justice sector. So by looking at different change programs, running different pilots, looking at different interventions, they want to really focus on that ministerial ambition under the government's Beating the Crime Plan. So as a finance business partner, I've got a team of about 10 finance business partners who report to me in terms of managing those portfolios of programs, as well as just doing the business as usual work, which has to carry on anyway. So I ended up there. It's a role that I took on in the last 12 months as a promotion opportunity. Previous to that, I did a bit of policy work. So the policy work that I did was very much linked to the David Lammy review into the criminal justice sector, where he found that people from ethnic minorities had poorer outcomes from the criminal justice sector because of the lack of diversity, especially at senior levels. I stepped out of finance for a bit, went and did that policy work, and then after 2.5 years, I've come back on a promotion on this role that I'm currently doing, which again, I've sort of enjoyed, and it's coming to an end very soon.
Oh, nice. Do you know what you're doing after this role ends?
So after, because of the fact that I've got like some care responsibilities, I want to have more opportunities to support my mom and the family. So I'm thinking about going into contracting work. So that gives me a bit more. Yeah, it will give me much more flexibility in terms of when I work, and also giving the flexibility to be able to travel back to Kenya now and again to be able to support my families.
OK, thank you. Have you ever been the victim of any indirect discrimination in your career or personal life? And how would you advise others to confront and tackle those situations?
I think that as a person of African descent, it is inevitable that I will experience discrimination because of the colour of my skin. It is something that we experience every day. You know, walk out the door, someone will look at me because they're not looking at me just because, oh, there's a person coming out. They look at me and they notice that, oh, yeah, that person is a Black person as well. So where society is just means that that is just the way that we experience discrimination on a day-to-day basis. And in terms of my personal career, you know, we've got policies within organizations that still have practices which hinder our potential in the workplace. So when we even, you know, it is very relevant when you look at the finance function and look at how representative it is of the profession. You know, we still have senior leaders who are very, very white. The spaces are still very white places. I think I mentioned before that statistically we are saying 5% of our leaders within the finance sector. It's less than 5% at the top. So that means that we are definitely experiencing some level of disproportionality where we are not looking at the talent that we have in the organization and driving that talent and also giving it the right opportunities to thrive. And I think that when we experience direct or indirect discrimination, it is where we don't have those opportunities for promotion in the same way that other people do. We don't have the same opportunities for training professionally. You know, sometimes funding is reduced. If someone wants to go and do a professional career qualification, you have to go through a process. And again, in that process, if you do not have the right support with the right manager, you might not necessarily get an opportunity to go on a professional training like CEPFA do with other ACCA or CIMA. So I think it is some of those lack of opportunities from within the organization, and you almost have to fight for it when other people don't have to. They just, it comes to them in a more easier way. So I think in terms of those, I have definitely experienced that. And also the fact that I've worked in different sectors, you know, I started in local government and then I moved to the health sector and now I'm working in central government. That has given me different experiences of some of these challenges in terms of just advising others about how they can do that. When I first started at central government, knowing what I had gone through in the previous sectors, one of my key things to do was get myself a mentor. And I just decided to go right to the top. I went to the director of finance and I said to her, can you be my mentor? Because I realized that I would need someone who might help me to open some of these doors. And by exposing myself directly to her, I was already saying, I want someone to consider that I also have potential and talent. And I need someone who is going to help me to channel those in a positive way in order for me to progress. And then from there, I just think that if there's any advice I can give to others, is to say, you have to continue to be authentic in trying to drive change. You have to accept that things are not what they're supposed to be. Sometimes we try and make excuses for the behaviors we see in the workplace. Sometimes we try to hide behind closed doors because we do not want our voices to be heard in the parapet, because you think, oh no, you know, I might lose my job or this might happen to me. Well, those are very real fearful experiences, and I can understand why sometimes people can do that. If you're the only voice on that table, you begin to be labeled. So the more people that you can bring with you, the better that you can actually make any change. So that means being visible, not being afraid to raise your head over the parapet, and also choosing the platforms where you can challenge effectively, because not every platform is going to be a good platform for you to challenge on. There are some people who are just waiting for you to open your mouth before they come down on you. So you have to remember where you are, which people around that table can be allies to you. So when you're saying or challenging some kind of behavior, that they have got that sense of understanding of where you're coming from. So, and I think that the more that you do that, you increase your own confidence, people begin to also, you know, value what you're bringing into the table. And so even in those some circumstances, someone will say, oh, this is happening. What is your point of view on this? So I think that is how sometimes we can help to tackle and confront those kind of situations.
What has been your experience as a Black woman working in the public sector finance? Would you like to see more diversity and more action taken by the employer?
Thanks, Chantel. I think that's a very important question, because all of these questions are linking in with the previous one. You know, when you're talking about direct or indirect discrimination, and then that experience, that is the experience that most of us have. And I think, you know, finance is a profession where, again, you know, it is not any different to any other profession where we would experience this. But when I think about my own experience, it has been varied. So when I started working in local government, I'd just come into this country. You know, I hadn't been here that long. I hadn't experienced, you know, all of this marginalization that happens here. Right. So this is something that comes with living here. And I joined the union straight away because I could see that there was a proportion in the union that was looking at networking and bringing self-organized groups around race and all the different protected characteristics. So I started off by understanding what I could do, how I could impact on some of these, going on some of those training which the union offered at the time, the conferences where you'd come together with other people who were experiencing some of those. Those were almost like the training grounds that I needed in order for me to be able to change my experience, because the experience of being undermined, that sits in there a lot. You know, you walk into a room and people are thinking, Oh, right. What does she know? What is she going to tell us that we don't already know? Is she even fit to be in this room? So any time that I've worked in any of these places as a finance professional, you get that initial, okay, let's study her and see whether she, you know, she's going to be any good at this. So it is always a question of having to disprove that a lot of the time. And that means that then you're always thinking about everything that comes out of your mouth because you don't know when it's going to be used against you. So when I moved to Bristol City, which was a very diverse city after starting with local government from where I lived before in Gloucester, I then thought the next logical thing to do was to get my SIPFA qualification because actually I had now begun to understand that if I was going to progress, getting qualified was going to be very key to that. So I joined Bristol City Council, and then I was quite lucky. I got a really good manager there who was very encouraging. And, you know, he was just like always pushing me with things, giving me stuff to do. And, you know, even getting into that opportunity to start studying, that was really good. And I even, you know, even whenever he could recognize my success when I worked there, moving on to the MOJ to become a finance business partner was just like having that fresh start, especially after I had just qualified, because when I started studying, I qualified while I was still working for the NHS. After I qualified, it was then quite easy for me to move out and get a role in the MOJ as a finance business partner, even though I took a pay cut, but I was willing to take a pay cut, but to have a fresh start. But I think, you know, the best thing to do is when I've experienced those kind of negative experiences of feeling undermined or someone wants to not recognize my input, I sort of think what is the most important thing for me is for me to recognize and validate myself. I don't necessarily always need someone else to validate me because I know what I am capable of. So just gaining that experience, that self-confidence.
Yeah, I agree with that. I feel like a lot of people should do that to their employers, kind of address those kind of problems and actually confront it. Final question. Finally, could you tell us about some of the work you've done with African Voices Forum? Who are they and what do they do?
Yeah, so African Voices Forum was an organization that was set up in Bristol in 2008. I think it was set up with the recognitions that people who were moving here from the continent, not just diasporan Africans, but people who were from the continent who were coming here, didn't feel like they had a voice into the mainstream. So, you know, the decisions, when you talk about health inequalities, we talk about the educational sector, they knew that they were going to be bringing their children up in this country. We needed to have a voice, basically. And that voice really needed to be able to feed into the mainstream. When things are happening, for instance, if we are facing issues with the police, we need to be able to meet up with them and say, hey, this is going on and we don't really like it. You need to think about this. So encouraging dialogue between those spaces where decisions are made, because we know that we are underrepresented. We don't have the same representation across the board. So our voices get lost in all that. So AVF was formulated by following the back of that, and it is made up of different associations, like, for instance, I'm a Kenyan, so I represent the Kenyan Association there. We've got the Ghanaian Association. We've got the Gambian Association. So all of those different countries in Africa have got representation on the board of African Voices Forum. And a lot of the activities that we get involved with are around social justice, obviously, because that is important. We try and look at those issues where we need some kind of intervention, like if it is health, we think about our young people who are going through the education system in this country, and we want to understand why, you know, what the barriers are, and we need to be able to find places where we can push policy that can help them to have better experiences here. They're growing up in this country now. Soon, if you know, we are sort of first generation, they are second generation, some of them are born here, we want them to have a really better experience. So a lot of that work is around social justice. We look at, we also think about environmental justice, because more widely we know that climate change is a big, big deal, and it is impacting on Africa the worst, even though Africa is one of the least polluters. You've got big polluters like, you know, like the States, China, all of those big polluters. But, you know, we are seeing the impact of climate change in Africa, and that is really having a huge impact on the lives of people in those places, farmers and all of those people who trying to drive the economic change and the environmental changes in there. So we think about environmental changes as part of our agenda. We think about how we support the growth, again, of young people, which is really important, which showcase a lot of our culture. And so through either newsletters, whichever mediums we do, Facebook, we have discussions, online debates, where we bring young people from here and young people from the continent and women as well, and just the general communities to have conversations. And then we sort of have discussions about how that shapes how our agenda. So that's what African Voices Forum do.
Thank you. That was the last question. Thank you for joining us, Penina.
That was Penina Achieng-Kinberg. Up next, we'll hear from Joe Seeley.
Hi, Joe, and thanks for joining us on this special Black History Month edition of SIPA Speaks.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So you're the new chair of the SIPA board. Would you like to tell our listeners about the board and what your role involves exactly?
Sure. So as you know, SIPA has a governance structure whereby we have the council that drive the purpose and ambition of SIPA. And then we have the organisation that's led by Rob and the executive team. And they're responsible for developing the strategy that's approved by council and managing the day-to-day of SIPA. And the board, the role of the board is to review the strategic plans, monitor and review strategy and performance, and provide oversight, you know, with respect to SIPA. And the board comprises members of the executive, non-exec directors, independent non-exec directors, and trustees, given the charitable status of SIPA. And my role is, as chair, is to effectively unlock the experience, knowledge, and insights that that group can provide to guide and make in decisions and help make decisions for SIPA that hopefully enable it to fulfill its ambitions and its growth aspirations. And I'm very honoured to have been appointed and given the opportunity to be the first independent chair.
Thanks, Joe. And of course, you're not just chair of SIPA board. You're also a co-founder and chief operating officer of Greater Pacific, which is an investment organisation that primarily concentrates on investing in the growth of India. How did you start the business? And could you tell us a little more about what it does exactly?
To get to that answer, a little bit of background. So my parents are immigrants from the Caribbean. My mother was a seamstress. My father was a janitor who ended up creating a little entrepreneurial business of his own. And they were immigrants to the country in the 60s. And through education, so I was brought up on a council estate. And through education, I've navigated my career through roles in the public sector, roles in the private sector, as a partner at KPMG and as a managing director at Goldman Sachs, which is an investment bank. And then ultimately, as an entrepreneur, setting up Greater Pacific Capital nearly 20 years ago now. And the idea, the origin of setting up Greater Pacific came from my partner, co-founder, Ketan, who's a Indian Gujarati. And we had the idea of using our collective wisdom and experience to raise capital and see whether we could entice investors to trust us with investing their money into high growth companies, predominantly in Asia, and as you say, India. And that's what we've been doing since about 2005. And so we've invested probably well over $1 billion in that time frame. And we have investors who entrust us with their money that include public pension groups, government finance institutes, government agencies, a range of institutional investors. And we deploy money on their behalf successfully for profit and purpose. So that's, in a nutshell, what Greater Pacific, the mission of Greater Pacific is to do. And it's a collective of individuals from very diverse backgrounds that have been operating, as I say, for nearly 20 years now.
Thanks, Joe. But we are here, of course, to talk about Black History Month. Why is it so important, do you think, that we celebrate Black History Month? And what would you like people of all colours to take away from it?
Well, I think Black History Month is hugely important for many reasons. On a personal level, a source of inspiration for me as a young boy was learning about the civil rights movement and the role Martin Luther King played in the struggles of Black people in the 50s and 60s. And that assignment, that history assignment, if you like, unlocked curiosity in me about the history of Black people and the challenges that they've faced through the ages to now. So on a personal level, it's been hugely important to me. And I think it's also important because Black history to me is about shared histories. It's about not just the history of Black people, it's about the history and the role with which Black people have played, for example, in the UK. And that's a shared history. And it's important that people of all colours understand the role that Black people have played in helping and evolve society as we live in today. So for me, Black History Month is an opportunity to celebrate and acknowledge the journey of those who came before us. And it gives us an insight as to how we are here today and both the positive and the negatives associated with that. So I think it's hugely important, and it's important beyond Black people. I think it's an important for society to understand the role that Black history plays in our shared history.
As you previously mentioned, you've worked in both the private and public sectors before. You previously worked at KPMG and Goldman Sachs. In your opinion, does the finance industry in general need to do more to encourage diversity and accessibility, specifically for Black people, or is it pretty good in your experience? And if not, what more should organisations be doing to improve this?
That's a long question. The short answer is that I think there needs to be more diversity in financial services and professional services. But I want to acknowledge, I think it's changed enormously from whence I began. Why is that important? Is that I think it's important that organisations reflect the customers, the clients, the people they serve, be they public service organisations or private sector organisations. And so the clients that we serve are diverse in nature, and I think the organisations that provide services to them need to reflect that diversity. And I think that's hugely important. My journey, when I began, there were very few individuals of colour in the financial services industry. There were few role models, but I think that's changed significantly over the years. But there's a long ways to go. But I'm encouraged by the nature of the dialogue and the conversations that now take place about how to encourage and get that inclusivity. And also I'm encouraged by the recognition that organizations will be richer and better for encouraging that inclusivity and diversity. We get to better answers, we get to better businesses, we get to better organizations when we unlock the potential of all the different constituents of society. And so I'm hugely encouraged by the progress that's been made, that, you know, small victories, including, you know, the appointment of myself, are illustrative in the chairman's role, are illustrative of the fact that change is happening, but there's ways to go. There's still progress to be made, but it's encouraging.
Moving on to your own personal experiences, is it possible for you to share any experiences when you've faced discrimination or adversity in your professional career because of the colour of your skin? And if you have, how did you overcome these challenges?
Well, look, discrimination is a societal issue. And so I, as a Black person, like any Black person, can recall and retell stories of discrimination they've faced on the school play yard, in different facets of education, in seeking to gain housing, and in one's career. And I look to the sort of changes that we see, whereby on the one hand, if you look to America, for example, we've had a Black president of the United States from 2009 to 2017. And in 2020, we had with George Floyd, the appalling acts of an individual killed in broad daylight because of their color of the skin. That's the reality of the discrimination that we see in society. So every Black person can recall stories, and I can recall my own stories of discrimination from my past. But with respect to your question as to how did I cope with it, the younger version of me sought to find organizations where, for example, in employment, I sought to find organizations where I thought I could be successful and I thought I would face less discrimination. And that's what drew me in the first instance to the public sector, because I saw more examples of diversity in the public sector. And I thought I would have a better opportunity of being successful in that arena. And so, and when I faced difficulty in my career, my response to that was to leave and find organizations where I believed I would be successful. The wiser version of me, the older version of me, as I traversed the challenges of my career, sought to have a dialogue with individuals in the organizations I worked in about the challenges of being successful in that organization as a Black professional, and trying to have the leadership help me understand what I could do and what they could do to make it easier for individuals to rise the ranks and achieve the status of partner or managing director. And what I found is that on that journey and in that dialogue, I learned a tremendous amount about how to turn what clearly, from my perspective, were adversity and obstacles into opportunities and ways and means of traversing some of the challenges of the organizations I was in. And I've met a number of senior individuals who became mentors and supporters and helped me become more determined, more focused at being the best version of me. And what they did in return was gave me their commitment that they would play their part in ensuring that I got opportunities to be promoted and be successful. So that's the way in which I kind of addressed some of the challenges of the, as I matured. And then when I became even more confident, I had the audacity, if you like, to believe that I could set up networks and groups within the organization. So at Goldman Sachs, I established something called the Firmwide Black Network, which was a forum to enable Black people to gather, to talk about their issues, to find mentors, to raise the profile of Black people in Goldman Sachs. It was a forum that enabled there to be a dialogue about the issues associated with inclusivity and the issues associated with climbing the ranks. So it was really, really hugely important, those sorts of very practical initiatives. And the final point I'd say, Mark, is one of the things I learned on that journey was the importance of actually surfacing the problem in a tangible way. And what I mean by that is one of the things that I think it's important for organizations to understand is what is the level of representation they have in their organization at different levels, you know, the backgrounds of their employees, and how are those individuals represented at different levels in the organization? How easy is it for individuals to become members of the executive team or the board? And in looking at the numbers, that can at least assist in understanding the scale of the problem, perhaps. So those are some practical things that over time I found were useful in having a constructive dialogue about how to change things which could be perceived as being discriminatory or obstacles to people succeeding in organizations.
You mentioned that as a youngster, you decided to start off in the public sector because you thought you would face less hurdles and less barriers than perhaps the private sector. And you've just described how you traversed your career and how you've formed networks and dialogues to overcome any potential problems or discrimination that you may have faced. But if you could say just one thing to that younger version of yourself who is just starting out in life and just beginning to choose their career path, but thinking that perhaps certain avenues you thought the private sector may offer you less opportunity, what advice would you give? What would be the one thing you say to the younger version of yourself?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And in simple terms, I would say to that individual, as was said to me in some respects, dream big, be bold, have courage, and be the change you want to see. And what I mean by that is small steps lead to major changes. And if you had said to me as a kid on a council estate running around kicking a ball where all my peers at that time were either getting into trouble with the law, prison and the like, the path out of that for me was education. But it was also dreaming and having individuals help me dream about what might be. And so what I would say, from whatever your background, whatever your environment, aspire to achieve. And I think my journey is one of change and possibilities. And I would say to a younger version of me, have the courage to go for that dream. And I've been very fortunate, I think, on that journey to experience some wonderful things, in part because of that aspirational sense of possibilities. And I think actually bringing this right back to where we started about Black history. When I think about the history of my parents and their journey as immigrants to the UK, what they saw was opportunity and aspiration and no guarantee as to what might be on the other side of that. And that's how I've sought to live my life. And I think there's tremendous opportunity. Yes, there are hurdles, but there's tremendous opportunity. And I would encourage a younger version of me to, as I say, dream big, be bold, have courage.
That seems like a very good place to end. Thanks, Joe, for sharing your experiences and story with us on Sipper Speaks.
Lovely. My pleasure. Thank you very much, Mark.
That was Joe Seeley. Up next, we'll hear from Lorraine Ashley.
So, Lorraine, please could you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your role at SITFA?
Hi, my name's Lorraine Ashley. I'm an international project coordinator at SITFA. I've been at SITFA since April 2022, so I've been here for 6 months. And on the international team, I have two main roles. So first part is developing relationships with PAOs and conceptualizing training projects to meet their needs. With that as well, there's the renewal of MOUs and the development of MOUs. Another main aspect of my role is international membership engagement. So I work on our membership benefits for our international members, and this can consist of CPD activities, masterclasses, webinars and events.
Great. I mean, it sounds really interesting. And so, as you said, you work on the international team at SITFA. So what kinds of things is your team responsible for?
So within the international team, there are two main elements of it. So we have international advisory, and advisory implement both long term and short term projects ranging from a few months to several years. And advisory have carried out numerous projects across the globe in Europe, Africa, Asia and the Caribbean. And the advisory team has successfully designed, developed and managed over 70 donor funded PFM capacity projects globally. And there's also the international relations team, which I'm on. And the international relations team focuses on growing SITFA internationally by developing relationships directly with governments and other PAOs around the world. So what I'd mentioned earlier, the renewal of MOUs, conceptualizing projects for PAOs and also international membership engagement. Within the international team, we also host international conferences. So we had our last conference in Albania. We also do webinars, guidance and codes, and produce international research.
Fantastic. It must be great knowing that your work's kind of having a global impact. That's great.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're focusing on Black History Month for this episode of SITFA Speaks. So my first question about that is, what does Black History Month mean to you?
To me, Black History Month is all about celebrating, recognizing, and an opportunity to learn. I would say, especially from my experience of history throughout growing up, it's been very Eurocentric. And it's not until I was an adult that I realized that there is so much Black history. There is so much history within Black history that is there that isn't related to slavery or colonialism, that societies had their own cultures, their own societies before colonialism. And I feel like my experience of history within education has been not painted Black history in the brightest light. So for me, Black History Month is all about recognizing the achievements that Black people have contributed to society. And again, as an avenue to learn, especially with social media campaigns. When I go on social media during Black History Month, I always find that I'm learning new things. So I see it as an opportunity to learn, recognize, and celebrate.
Great. So Mallory Blackman actually recently spoke out about her belief that rather than Black History Month, there should be more education about Black history in schools all year round. What's your take on that?
So I agree with this, but I don't think that it should be a trade-off. I feel like we can still have Black History Month and that Black education should still be taught in schools. So I think Black History Month was founded in the UK in 1978, so it's been around for 35 years. So I'd agree that we need to move towards more substantial outputs from this month, whether that's institutional changes, So definitely changes to curriculums. And it's really interesting you asked this question because the theme of Black History Month this year is action, not words. So I feel like that fits in really well. If we've been having Black History Month for this many years, it would be good for there to be some substantial change that has come about from it. I also think it's really essential to learn about your history, and it's really good for a sense of belonging and just general mental health in general, especially because we live in a multicultural society and Black people have contributed to society. So I feel that Black students hearing about and learning about the achievements of their ancestors, it's really, really important. And if within education you're hearing things about history that doesn't necessarily relate to you or your past or your identity, I feel that there runs the risk of a feeling of inferiority, especially when that history has been painted in such a stark and dark light. So I would 100% agree with this. And I feel like you can truly be proud about your history if you learn about your history. I mean, I'm 25 and I'm still learning. So I would 100% agree with this statement. And I would say it's quite good because in my last year of university, especially, there was a lot of talks about decolonializing the curriculum. So I feel like there needs to be more of that push. We need to be pushing to have a history that reflects all of the people that are sitting in that classroom.
So you mentioned there about mental health of Black students, and if there was kind of a bit more, if there was a bit more representation and a bit more education, do you feel that that would have kind of measurable benefits for mental health of Black students?
I believe so. I feel like if you're constantly seeing the history of your ancestors in such a negative dark light, where you're not seeing their contributions to society, it's gonna make you feel as though, like, what were my ancestors doing? Because that history is essentially hidden. So I feel like it would definitely help the mental health of young people and their sense of belonging, their sense of community, and make them feel proud about their history and celebrating their history.
I mean, it makes complete sense as well. If you're allowed, in a way, to feel proud and to celebrate your history and your ancestors, then I guess it's going to have benefits for everyone kind of going forward as well.
Absolutely. That sense of belonging, it's your past. So if you don't know about it and you're only hearing history from one side, I feel like that will definitely have detrimental impacts. And there has been research on this. So there's also research to back this up.
So throughout your career history, I mean, you said you're 25, so I don't know kind of how many jobs you've had, but do you feel that enough is being done to champion inclusion and diversity?
I would say from my experience, things are being done. Would I say enough is being done? I don't think I'll ever say enough is being done, just because there is so much more that can be done. There are so many more uncomfortable conversations that some people might not want to talk about that we need to be talking about. I would say what is being done is good from my experience, but I haven't seen much substantial change in organizations I have worked for when it comes to inclusion and diversity. And I feel like it just needs to be a continual thing and not something that's kind of done momentarily, or we're going to focus on diversity and inclusion. I feel like if it's something that is included and embedded into an institution, that's when enough is being done, because it's actually not being spoken about, but substantial things are being done to make sure that all employees feel that they can speak about diversity and inclusion, can have these conversations.
What is your proudest achievement?
I would say my proudest achievement is my two publications from my previous jobs, where I did research and policy. Especially after graduating university, I was really into research. So just having that opportunity to have a publication, work on something really hard that had been put out there for other people to see, and something that had had substantial impacts on the people that I was doing the research for. So I would definitely say that is my proudest achievement today.
Great, that's fantastic. I'm putting you on the spot here, so sorry, but you mentioned earlier that you, every kind of Black History Month, you, like, there's things that you are still learning. Yes. So is there anything that you've learned this year or last year that you'd like to share with our listeners?
So there is something I learned last year, and it was on inventions by Black people. So the light bulb, the traffic light, a lot of things in our day-to-day lives that I hadn't necessarily known was invented by a Black person. So for me, that was really interesting, because I have never learned about this anywhere throughout my education. It's not something that I would say is easily accessible. It's this is why I feel like it's so important that organizations and people do run these social media campaigns to get the word out there, get messages out there, because I saw that also as an avenue to go and learn more about this. So I found that something very interesting. And yeah, just a lot of inventions that make life easier were invented by Black people, and it's not something I'd heard about. So I found that very interesting.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing. And thank you for being on Sit for Speaks with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sitfor's Lorraine Ashley. Black History Month is a time to celebrate Black excellence, and this year it is a time for continued action to tackle racism and to make sure Black history is celebrated all year round. From key figures in our society to the achievements and contributions that Black people make to the UK every day. We really hope that during this episode you've learned something and will be inspired to go away and keep this conversation open all year round. That's all we have time for today. Previous episodes can be found on Sitfor's website or wherever you like to listen. Be sure to follow us on social media for more and to make sure you never miss another episode. We'll be back next month. Thank you and goodbye.